All right. Well, thank you everyone for coming. I might use this very useful hockey stick to point out some things on the slides, if you don't mind the awkwardness of it. So as you can see from the name of my talk, I'm going to be telling you about some quantum dynamics. But in particular, you know, this is going to be coming from some work that I published with some colleagues that will be soon published in PRL, along with some ongoing work from it. Realistically, though, a lot of this talk is actually kind of my attempt to understand these quantum dynamical, you know, aspects from my perspective as someone who's focused a little bit more on traditional, more equilibrium-based condensed matter systems. And so let's launch right into it. Now, the motivation for this, as with many aspects of quantum dynamics, is quantum thermalization. Now, quantum thermalization is kind of this delicate dance between the degrees of freedom in a system and its environment. In particular, if you want to look at the dynamics within a quantum system, through its density matrix, realistically, you need to look at the evolution between both the system and its environment. However, you know, if you're just looking at the system, you eventually need to trace out that environment. You do that after the evolution. Now, unfortunately, that means if you're looking at your system, it will look as though you have lots of unitary dynamics happening within your system, but because you're uncertain about the configuration of the environment, now it's going to look as though you have some random or some ensemble of different unitaries acting in your system. Now, a very good way to model all of this is through something called random unitary circuits. I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, have heard or seen these. And this is effectively done by layering multiple different unitaries, one on top of another, here in a brickwork framework, and then averaging the effect of these unitaries over some particular measure. Now, this is incredibly useful because you can obtain lots of different dynamical phenomena just from the very structure of this system. And you can obtain some generic phenomena by using, you know, different tricks or averaging or different models. So one thing that I'd like to point out is if you have, say, some ground state, which is a nice product state, you apply a local operator at some local site, then you can immediately see that there should be some, you know, some velocity, some fixed rate of spreading ballistically for this operator front. And you can get that just from the locality of this random unitary circuit. So to make things a little concrete, because I know I always need a bit of intuition, let's just look at, say, a system that we might actually be interested in. We have some spin chain, we add some polarization so that it has a nice ground state, which is all polarized in one direction, and then we add some interaction to it. Say here, we have some randomly varying B field. Now, what that means is that now we're going to have some interaction with all the different spins that will be different on the different sites. And if that interaction is strong enough, it can actually destroy the order. That interaction can change over time. And if it changes over time in a particular fashion, it can not only destroy the order that was there presently, but it could potentially introduce a different order. Now, that's not the only interaction we can have. We can also have interactions that couple different sites. So my nice cheesy animation, we could have some interaction which causes different sites to wobble together or to vibrate in another sense. And that can cause local disorder, or again, it can change the order of the state itself. And so, you know, as all of you I'm sure will know, it's very nice to describe this as a ground state initially when it's well ordered, but if we have these interactions which are causing decoherence, we now have to look at this as a density matrix, not just as a quantum state. Now, one of the most useful ways to model these systems or to obtain some information from these quantum circuits is through something called Haar averaging. Now, Haar averaging is extremely powerful, and effectively it's actually quite easy to understand. It's basically just taking the uniform measure over all possible unitaries that have the appropriate local unitary structure in some basis. So you take a basis, you have some representation of this unitary, and you average over all different iterations. Now, in this case, I'm doing two copies of the system so that we have four unitaries, one on each side of each density matrix. Now, if you perform this Hart averaging, then you can transform this configuration of multiple unitaries into tensors at each site. And the tensor configuration will now have different weights for the different incoming and outgoing configurations. Now, this is particularly useful in this one case, because we can transform what was originally this quantum circuit into a configuration that we understand much better, namely something that has different weights at different junctures. And if we take the sum over all of these weights, we get a statistical mechanical partition function. And so we've transformed something which we might not be very familiar with, this random unitary circuit with all this dynamical information, into something that's very, very familiar. We have a statistical mechanical partition function. We can obtain all sorts of thermodynamic data and transform that back into information about our dynamical system. And so all of this is done with this, you know, this very simple tool, Hart averaging.
Are the weights all positive?
Sorry?
Are the weights positive?
Are the weights positive?
Yeah.
In this case, yes, they are.
Are they necessarily positive? Are there cases in which they're not positive?
I think they should always be positive, at least in this case, because they should. The weights in this case are particular. They're taken by collapsing different effective like permutations of different incoming weights, and so they should be a sum of the different. Loops that you get for each incoming configuration. It's hard, I don't have any demonstration here. I think that they should be. I'd be happy to double check and can speak a little bit more after, if that's okay. But this is just one demonstration or one example of how this can be a very particular tool. And again, using this Hart averaging tool, Hart averaging mechanism. It's particularly useful because often it gives you some kind of analytical framework. Oftentimes it can even be computationally very useful, but it can be a bit of a coarse description. As I said, we were taking the uniform measure over all unitaries. And so if there's a particular interaction that you care about, or if you'd like to focus on something that, you know, preserves a particular symmetry, you're kind of at a loss unless you add something more to your model. Now, my motivation for doing this is actually looking at what happens when you do actually do that. You add something more to this Hart averaging framework. Now, as I said before, when you have an unconstrained circuit, then you have an operator weight that should spread ballistically just from the locality constraints of your circuit. And so that's what you see here. These are different time steps and what's effectively happening. On the x-axis, you have some distance, and on the y-axis, what you have is effectively the number of operators that have a front that extends out to this rightmost edge. So at this late time, many, many operators, most operators have have support extending out this far. So in an unconstrained circuit, you can see that this operator front is spreading ballistically. However, when you put in number conservation or some U1 conservation, this changes in two particular fashions. You still have your ballistically spreading front. However, you have an additional lump in the middle where you have slower dynamics. We'll see it'll be diffusive dynamics. And on top of that, you actually have this tail connecting the two. Now, it turns out understanding this, even with the Hart averaging framework, is not too difficult. What you do is you pick a very particular representation, namely the representation of your symmetry basis. And if you do that, you can decompose each of your unitaries into different symmetry sectors. Now, once you've done that, in this case, for a spin 1/2 system, you have spin 1, negative 1, and 0. This particular configuration is going to have easily understood dynamics for sigma z operators. Namely, it will cause effectively equilibration or an averaging of the two sigma z's at the sites connected by the unitary. And this will cause some random walk phenomena, which will eventually result in the exact diffusive dynamics that you would expect. you'd have decay of some autocorrelation function with 1 over root t. And so the main takeaway is if you impose a symmetry in a system, you expect slow dynamics for particular operators, namely these charged operators here, sigma z. Now, I'm going to try to convince you. Oh, please.
The other operators.
Yes.
Do they behave in the same way as the random case?
Yes, that is a bit interesting. Ooh. So the symmetry operators, the sigma z's in this case, are going to comprise this diffusing lump in the middle. However, what is important to note is in this total system, there's going to be some constraint of unitarity that actually is its own symmetry in this formulation. It's kind of the total weight of these operators, and that will importantly come from the square of some operator weight. The conservation here that's happening comes from be like the amplitude of these symmetry operators. So effectively what happens is there's going to be some conservation exclusively just for these charged operators. So the diffusion here is just for these sigma z's. The other operators do not act that way. That's why you still have this ballistically spreading front. So any operator except for the local sigma z's will still spread ballistically. And the reason that you have this tail phenomena is actually, while this is diffusing, the total operator weight supported on this charge is going to decrease, and it's going to leak some other operators that causes this tail phenomena. That might have been a little more detailed than you asked for, but is that good? Sure. So like I said, I'm going to try to convince you that we can look at this phenomenon in another light that will actually open up understanding different phenomena in a bit more of an intuitive framework, at least to me. And in addition to that, it will actually allow for us to look at some new interesting phenomena, again, from this new perspective. Now, typically, as I said, if you want to look at dynamics, what you'll do is you'll look at some ensemble average over unitaries acting on some density matrix. Now we're going to transform this in two fashions. First, we're going to take this density matrix and we're going to vectorize it. We're going to take a density matrix and transform it kind of back into a quantum state. I'll explain a little bit more about how to do that in a bit. And then we're going to shift perspective from Heisenberg evolution by this ensemble of different unitary operators to an imaginary time Schrodinger evolution over this vectorized state. And again, I'll talk a little bit about why it's imaginary time. You can understand it effectively as there should be some decay over particular weights rather than just evolution. Now, this is particularly nice because this allows us to exploit a duality between the dispersion from this effective Hamiltonian and dynamics that we would expect in the operator framework. Namely, if we can find some eigenstates for this particular effective Hamiltonian, then just taking an inner product here, we should immediately be able to infer what some dynamical phenomena here given by the autocorrelation function. Specifically, if we find something which has a gapless dispersion that has some polynomial form, then just using the form up here, you should be able to immediately infer that late time dynamics is now going to also decay in some polynomial fashion, given by t minus d over n, d being the dimension of the system. And so immediately we have a conjecture over why this diffusion happened in the charge conserving system. We just say if that is the case, then we should expect our effective Hamiltonian should have a quadratic gapless spectrum, and that would explain the diffusive behavior. That would explain the late time effects on the autocorrelation function. Now that's all well and good, but I'd like to argue that this framework is actually extremely versatile and can cover lots of different phenomena. Namely, we can look at multipole conservation, where we have some order of multipole, m, where we'll see that the dispersion becomes a bit more sharp, 2 to the m plus 1, and that will cause some dynamics that are a bit slower. We have some subdiffusion. We can also look at constrained dynamics, which I'll make a bit more precise in a bit. But in constrained dynamics, these ones specifically within multiple conserving systems, we can actually recover dynamics that are a bit faster than the dynamics purely in a multiple conserving system by looking at particular sectors that constrain the dynamics even further. And finally, I'll talk about some long-range interactions where the range of the interactions is governed by some parameter alpha in there. And there we'll see that there are different phases of the dynamics governed by the range of this interaction.
So when you show the expression of H effective from the ensemble of US, later will you do that?
Yes, yeah, that's, I'm just setting up what we'll cover now. But before I do so, the general picture is effectively just saying we're going to establish some effective Hamiltonian, which will have some dispersion. And that should predict immediately the late time dynamics of some autocorrelation function, some late time dynamical behavior. So before I launch into the framework, actually try to derive all of these things and convince you of what I've been trying to sell, does anyone have any questions about the setup or the framework?
Is the D in your previous slide the space dimension or space time dimension?
Space dimension, yeah.
Space.
Yes. Anything else? Okay. All right, so the framework that I'm going to be using is something called...
So the row that you're taking the expectation value in for the unequal time correlator
Yes, I am taking the expectation value.
So this row, are you going to take it to be like an infinite temperature state or...?
So initially, in the work that I did, we did take it to be an infinite temperature state. That is not necessary, but things become much more complicated if you don't take that assumption. So I'll at the very end of this talk, that's kind of one of the future directions that we're moving in. We'll discuss that. Yeah.
Do you mean some of those statements are initial state dependent?
So yes, the configuration here are kind of initial state dependent, as we said, of looking at what happens for particular particular operators or particular subsets or aspects of a density matrix. So if we take this operator to be some low energy eigenstate, then the rest of this follows. If this is a very high energy state, then it won't survive in the late time dynamics. However, you can generalize this framework. It just means that some of the dynamical information may be a little harder to obtain from it. So yes, what I'm saying is initial state dependent to some degree. The particular information about autocorrelation functions will be, but the general duality will hold.
Oh, I thought what you just explained is that the result will be operator dependent.
Will be
the initial state dependence is in the row.
Well, so the operator here is understood as part of a superposition of this density matrix. So say you start with a density matrix, which is in, like in the beginning, in some nice product state. Now you can have some small excitation over it by applying some operator at a local site. And now that's going to be in some excited state. And that, just assuming you're in some, say, maximally mixed state is the ground state initially, you apply a local operator O at some local site. That local operator may be a superposition of lots of different low energy excitations here. And so we'll be looking at the dynamics of those low energy excitations or operators.
I see. So physically speaking, it depends on both the operator and also the physical initial state.
The two are one and the same. So these operators that we're looking at are configurations. They are part of the initial density matrix that we're looking at. So we're looking at the initial density matrix, and I should clarify, please, if you get confused between state and operator. Please let me know, because what we're doing is going to be translating one into the other. So the initial state for the effective Hamiltonian evolution is the same as saying the initial density matrix for the operator evolution. Does that make things a bit more clear?
And then the choice of the object, is the choice of the object independent of the initial state or not?
The choice of the operator will be independent if you're just looking for, you know, finding a dispersion. But if you want to look at the evolution of this operator over a certain initial configuration, then yes, there's going to be some some overlap of that initial configuration with that operator. That's important. I can show some more details about that at the very end if you'd like. I do have a slide if the question still remains.
So what does the state with zero energy represent?
With zero energy, that's going to be a steady state, so something that doesn't change over time. And I'll show a bit more of that in the framework in two or three slides. Any other question? Yeah.
Are other eigenstates necessarily physical states in the sense they are density matrices, or?
So if you start with a density matrix, then the dynamics will preserve it being in a density matrix. So yes, the eigenstates that you have, so long as this effective Hamiltonian, you know, is a good one that actually reproduces physical dynamics, then yes, they will all be physical density matrices.
Can N be infinity?
Can N?
Yeah. Can N be zero?
Can N be zero? Yes, yes. So importantly, when N is zero, that effectively means that you just have a gap. And what happens when you have a gapped Hamiltonian is you're going to have exponential suppression of any particular operator, which actually happens if you have an unconstrained circuit. What it means is, you know, as you look at longer and longer circuits, you're going to have exponentially many different operators. And so you would expect, if you can couple to any arbitrary number of them, there would be an exponential suppression of the weight on any particular operator.
Actually, sorry, maybe I missed this part. Is H effective guaranteed to be Hermitian?
No. That's actually going to be important later. I'm going to construct things in a way that will make it Hermitian, but later on I'll talk about how it's important and how to understand it when it's... Some guesses on how to understand it when it's not. But that's a very good question. But I think some of these might be made a bit more clear if I launch into the framework, so I'm going to push ahead. Please do ask any questions if they come up. So the framework is called Brownian-Hamiltonian evolution. And effectively, what's going on here is instead of averaging over an entire unitary block, now we're going to break up this unitary by looking at effective interactions, the Hamiltonian term in the exponent. And what we'll be doing is we have multiple different interactions that we can look at, indexed by some alpha, which includes both the site index and some interaction index. And instead of averaging over all possible unitaries, we're going to be averaging over particular interactions. And this average is going to be carried out with a Brownian weight, or a Brownian interaction strength, which will have zero mean, and will have a variance that scales inversely with the time. It's kind of for normalization purposes. Now, if we do this averaging, it gives us a bit more fine-tuned control over the type of unitaries that we'll be using. And in particular, it will give us a type of operator evolution called Lindblad evolution here. So if you carry out this interaction, you pull down the different Hamiltonians for short increments, then you'll have operator evolution given by this particular form. And note that because we need to pull down two Hamiltonians, the imaginary component has vanished. Now, the next step in all of this is to convert this, like I said, to vectorize this. Now, there's a fancy term, Choi. I think there's also another name, Jablonski or something. God will forgive me for omitting it. But effectively, all we do is we take the bra in this operator, we turn it into a ket, and you act on it by the operator you're using. Now, if you do this, then you can turn this Lindblad evolution, this Lindblad superoperator, transform the operator evolution here, into imaginary time Schrodinger evolution of a vectorized operator. And importantly, you get an effective Hamiltonian that takes this form.
So, to make sure, so db is a random variable?
DB, yes. It's a Brownian random variable.
Do you mean only under this assumption of DB you obtain this imaginary time evolution?
Yes, yes. So only if we're averaging in this particular framework where we have some Brownian random weight on each of these interactions, then we obtain a purely imaginary Schrodinger evolution. Now, at the end, the effective Hamiltonian that we get in this case is actually Hermitian, because each of these interaction terms H alpha is Hermitian. However, we'll see that we can generalize this framework in a way where it may not be Hermitian. And so, it being Schrodinger evolution, imaginary time is a bit more complicated.
Am I correct that so far the only assumption is about the distribution of the DB?
The only shift from the hard averaging perspective? Sorry, what? The assumption?
Yeah, what are the assumptions here?
So we've put in some, some form to the interactions alpha, and yes, you're right that we have some assumption about how the interactions are going to go with the DB. You can also add that we've, at least in this context, we put that the interactions are all Hermitian. I guess you can add some locality to it, as we will later. I think that's effectively it. Yeah.
So this limb-like evolution is supposed to be like the most general form of evolution of the density operator that's compatible with like general constraints, right?
Right, so this is...
There's no minimum.
This is a particular type of Lindblad evolution, and at the end we'll talk about the more general... I'm sure many of you have seen the Lindblad equation. The Lindblad equation can be transformed into an effective Hamiltonian, and in that case it will be non-Hermitian generically. So I'll flash that at the end. But yeah, that's a good point. Any other questions on initial framework?
Can you give me any intuition why, in the end, this unitary evolution become something that looked like a dissipation?
Effectively what we are looking at, well, it is kind of a dissipative system. We're looking at something that's thermalizing. And again, maybe some really good intuition is to look at what happens, say, before when it was a gapped Hamiltonian. In that case, you have... because this is some imaginary time, you have some exponential suppression. And now what that means is effectively you are dispersing the weight on a particular operator, a particular component of your density matrix, into exponentially many other different components. Another way to understand it is because you're averaging over different configurations of these unitaries, you're kind of accounting for different potential, different configurations of your environment that are transforming this from potentially a pure initial state into a mixed state. And so you're having a decay of some initial states.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Basically, you have some randomness in your Hamiltonian that you don't control, so it becomes a mixed state.
Exactly.
Here, this O is not related to the density matrix, right?
Yes and no. We can take this O to be the density matrix. You have to. This is just for an arbitrary operator. So this O could be the full density matrix, or it can be some component of it. It's just left general so that we can see the formalism.
It can just be some observable.
Yes. So there's a bit of a technical detail where you can look at the evolution of observables, or you can look at the evolution of some density matrix. In the case that we're looking at right now, when we have just pure Hermitian terms, it will turn out that difference is kind of inconsequential. The dynamics looks effectively the same. When we add coherent dynamics, when we look at more general Lindblad evolution, I should say, then the effect of Hamiltonian will turn out to be non-unitary. And there will be a difference between evolution of observables and density matrices that effectively amounts to the fact that orthogonality looks strange in non-unitary systems. Right and left states do not share the same eigenspaces. I don't know. There's a bi-orthogonality that kind of explains this difference. But that is a good point. In this case, it doesn't matter. But more generally, you do have to be careful if you're talking about the evolution of an observable or your density matrix itself. Any other questions? All right. Now, as I said, this effective Hamiltonian takes a particularly nice form. And you can immediately infer some properties from it just by looking at the form of this effective Hamiltonian. Namely, it's the sum of a bunch of different square terms, or terms squared. So we can rewrite it in this form. And that's particularly nice because we immediately can tell that it's going to have a positive definite spectrum. Each of these terms, at best, could have a minimum of zero, and thus, you know, the entire Hamiltonian must have some spectrum that is, like I said, positive definite.
Sorry, so here, if you didn't take the mean of the coupling to be non-zero, then your Hamiltonian would be non-Hermitian, isn't it?
If I didn't take the mean of the coupling to be zero?
Non-zero, non-random coupling.
So the mean of that averaging was zero. The variance was not, was scaled inversely with the...
You took the mean to be zero, right?
Yes.
But if it was not zero, is it correct that Hamiltonian would be non-Hermitian?
Yes, exactly.
So any distribution of zero mean will give Hermitian.
So long as your interaction terms are a Hermitian, yes. Now, we immediately know that it has a positive definite spectrum, but in addition, we can show that it has a frustration-free ground state, namely the identity matrix, or the vectorized form of it. And this is because this interaction, when put back into the operator formalism, is nothing more than taking the commutator with this interaction alpha. And so, you know, we all know our favorite operator that commutes with everything, the identity matrix. And so immediately, not just the whole Hamiltonian, but each individual term and each of these, for lack of a better term, I'm going to call root Hamiltonians. Never figured out a good way to express these. But each of those terms kills the identity matrix. And thus, because it minimizes each term individually, we have a frustration-free ground state. Important for a technical reason we don't have to go over, but because it minimizes that, as we said, it minimizes the full Hamiltonian, we have a nice ground state. But this is very nice because we can actually characterize dynamical systems in a more general framework by looking at something called the bond algebra, which is just a collection of all different interaction terms that we would be using in our particular framework. Now, the bond algebra may be boring, but its cousin or centralizer, the commutant algebra, is much more important. Now, the commutant algebra is, as I said, the centralizer, and it's effectively defined just by all operators that commute with all the terms in the bond algebra. And because of this, the way that this is formulated, that immediately means that anything that is in this commutant algebra is immediately going to be a ground state of our effective Hamiltonian. And then just a reminder of a way that you can actually write this in our vectorized format, kind of a symmetrized way on both the bra and the ket space. Now, this is really nice because if you want to look at things in the operator formalism, you can immediately deduce the ground state degeneracy of your system. It's just all of the elements in your commutant algebra. And so the ground state degeneracy of this effective Hamiltonian should just be the dimension of this commutant algebra.
Is commutant algebra basically just the symmetries of the Hamiltonian?
It can be more general than just the symmetries, but if all you have, the only structure is symmetries, then yes, effectively.
So what would be a case where it's not symmetry, but it's in the commutant algebra?
We'll go over one where you have, say, Kirilov subspaces, Krylov, I always mispronounce things, but say you have some ergodicity breaking, and you have, say, quantum many-body scar or something, there will be sectors that are invariant, even though they're not described by some symmetry sector.
If it's something that commits a Hamiltonian, you almost would say that there is a symmetry, right? But you're saying that it's not like a local operator.
Fair. Then yes. Yeah. Then under that definition, it's just all the symmetries. Yeah. Thanks. So yeah, now let's go to symmetries, or I think in this case, focusing on global symmetries applied to local applied locally. So we actually have to be careful when we look at dynamics, and that's because there are actually two different types of symmetries. The first, the one we'll be focusing on most today, are called strong symmetries, and those in this framework can be understood as each of these interactions respects some symmetry. In this case, if we do U1, or number-conserving symmetry, each of these interactions commutes with the total charge operator. Now, because these interactions occur on both the bra and the ket space, that means we actually have two different commutators that have to vanish on the left and the right. In contrast, we can have something called weak symmetry, which just means that the total dynamics, or the entire density matrix, not all of its individual components, has to commute with the total charge. And that can be represented by difference in the total charge on each site. So what that means is, effectively, when we have a strong symmetry, it means that we have a U1 symmetry on both the left and the right. This effectively accounts for the Hermitian conjugation of the density matrix. Now, in the weak symmetry case, because we have to look at this difference, you only preserve one of these unitary symmetries, which is the diagonal component. But for a little bit more of an intuitive framework on what's actually going on here, we can kind of understand these as the difference between a canonical and a grand canonical ensemble. In a canonical ensemble, you have a fixed particle number. Even if it's interacting with a bath, the number of particles in your system will always be the same, and you have a particular thermal ensemble that you achieve. In a grand canonical ensemble, you still have a particle number, but that particle number, those particles can be exchanged with your system. And effectively, that's what's going on here. In a weak symmetry, your total system and environment may conserve this U1 symmetry, so you have a good particle number, but many of the different configurations within can be exchanging charge with your system. Now, to get diffusion or to get these different modes, we kind of want to have a fixed particle number, so we'll be focusing on strong symmetry. And as Dominic noted before, we immediately know if something is a symmetry of our system, it should be a ground state. Now, if it is a ground state, then we have a symmetry. We might look for some low energy charge fluctuations. Now, if those are approximate symmetries, namely they commute to within some polynomial power, then that will actually translate into there being a dispersion for our effective Hamiltonian that will also have a similar dispersion for these states. Now, effectively, this means that if we want low energy states, we want to look for approximate symmetries of our system. Now, looking at that.
You didn't follow the last equation.
Sure. Oh, always terrible with this.
What does the first equation mean? Like,
so the first equation is saying that we have, in addition to our identity matrix, we have another ground state, namely the total symmetry of the system. So in this case, just charge. So
the notation is confusing because like row, like it's a density matrix, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's a bit annoying because I don't know how to get around it. So I should have said at the beginning of the talk, if you ever see a hat on a row, that means it's talking about a density matrix. If you do not see a hat, then it's talking about charge density. I just couldn't get away with using Q or some of these other letters because there's too much coverage. But yes, thank you. I know it's a bit confusing. If rho does not have a hat, then it's a charge density. If it does have a hat, it's a density matrix. So in this case, it's just total charge Q. The total charge is invariant in the system, so it's a steady state or a ground state of this effective Hamiltonian. If we look at charge fluctuations, long wavelength charge fluctuations, those are approximate symmetries if they're very long wavelength, and so they should approximately commute. This doesn't really need to be a rho k, it can be something else, but it means that this will be something very, very small, and thus if we look at, I guess if I'm looking for eigenstates, it should. So then if we look at the vectorized form of this charge fluctuation, we would expect or hope that it would have some very low energy dispersion in this formalism.
In the second equation, you're commuting the local Hamiltonian with some long wavelengths rho k, but
yes,
there's no position dependence on the right hand side. And on the left hand side, there is a position dependence, right? You write x.
Yes, there absolutely should be, but mostly
some
just
over x or something.
Yeah, I think there should be a sum over x at some point. Yeah, this was mostly just for intuition. I'll go over the explicitly how we do this in a bit.
That's just also comment. Like here, you are like using the operator and the state in the same way, because you are like evolution is kind of, your jump operator is kind of permission, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So, but what else can you see? Can you say anything about like the case where the jump operator is not permission?
Yes, we can.
Is the argument still holds or not?
So this argument still holds. As I said, it'll be non-Hermitian, and so the dispersion at the end will not all be real. That's effectively all you need. There are some additional subtleties with defining what the appropriate ground states are. Again, because of this difference between operator evolution and density matrix evolution. But this general framework or this intuition still carries through. Yeah.
In the last equation, you've shown that the dispersion is gapless. Does this gaplessness imply anything physically about the system?
Yeah, so the gaplessness is actually what implies that you're going to have slow dynamics. If you have a gap, as I said before, if you have a gap in your effective Hamiltonian, then because it's imaginary time, that means you're going to have exponential suppression of a particular state. Over time, it's just going to exponentially decay. When it's gapless, you have to be a bit more careful because, well, it's not going to be exponentially suppressed. You're going to have to, in this case, integrate over different momentum modes. And then the dynamics that you'll get, as we saw before, can be polynomial in time.
So other than just the time scaling, does it tell anything about the entanglement, for example?
So yes, it's a bit more subtle how to construct what the entanglement looks like. I will show you in a bit. It does not directly imply something. It's not immediately apparent from this perspective, though.
Is it true that the last line holds only for strong symmetry?
Yes, only for strong symmetry, because we were looking at strong symmetry is everything commutes with each of these interactions, and so an approximate symmetry is one that approximately commutes with each of these interactions.
So there's no long time for weak symmetry?
So generically, if you put in a weak symmetry, you do not have to have these slow dynamics. Yes. Yeah.
Actually, is that true? Are you basically saying I don't have to have diffuse dynamics if I'm in grand canonical ensemble?
It's not immediate.
But there can be.
Sorry, I thought the ensemble thing was just an analogy.
Sorry?
The ensemble thing is just an analogy.
It is just an analogy.
It's not really a difference between canonical ensemble and grand canonical ensemble. In that sense, like what is different from this case, where there really is a difference between strong symmetry and weak symmetry.
Well, yes, it's just saying that if I have a canonical ensemble, I know that I have particle number conservation. I have a fixed number. And so I can think about it as I have this fixed number that's going to, say, go on some like random walker is going to diffuse through this system. If I have a grand canonical ensemble, I don't know the dynamics of the exchange with the system. And so I don't know if there can be stuff being poured in or taken out that might mess with the diffusive dynamics that I derive.
Right, but in equilibrium, like the charge fluctuation scale is like some extensive thing. So it doesn't really matter, but you're talking about non-equilibrium systems, right? So it's different.
Yes, I'm saying it takes a little bit more work if you have a weak symmetry or a grand canonical ensemble to see the same thing. That's it. And it's not necessary in this framework.
Yeah, sorry, I interrupted.
No, no.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Like, seems that this argument implies that once you are, like, Lindabladian has a strong U-1 symmetry, necessarily
yes.
It is gapless. Is that what you are implying here?
Yes.
Well, I don't think that is proven. Well, I agree, it's a good intuition, but that's...
So this is actually a very interesting and good point. You might not expect this from, I don't know, Merman Wagner or something. This is actually something where the frustration-free aspect of the effect of Hamiltonian is actually really essential. It hasn't been proven, but there is a wealth of both numerical and analytical evidence as to why that should still happen. And that's actually the subject of some work with one of my colleagues, with someone else. But it, you know, without an explicit proof, there's about as much evidence as we could possibly have. You put in a strong U1 symmetry, and you have a gapless spectrum.
I got confused. What exactly is proven here? Do you have a proof that n is necessarily positive, or what?
No, just that it's gapless. So there's no gap between. Spectrum when you put in a U1 symmetry, strong U1 symmetry.
That is proving n is positive.
There's no formal proof, I don't think, but yes, that it is positive, I think.
So sorry, I just want to know what exactly is the statement you're making. Are you saying that...
The statement is if I put in a strong U1 symmetry into the system, then immediately I can infer that I'm going to have a gapless spectrum.
That's provided the middle one has k to the n with n positive, right?
So this statement is kind of foregoing this kind of intuitive explanation of it. It's just saying, if I have a strong U1 symmetry in my dynamics, can I immediately infer that the spectrum is going to have some, or it's, the spectrum is going to be gapless?
Okay.
This step is trying to give intuition that if it is going to be gapless, the first place that I would look is some charge fluctuations that would be approximate symmetries. Yeah. So I thought
previously you said it could be gapped.
Not with this symmetry. I'm just saying generically you can find an effective Hamiltonian that could be gapped. So if you don't put in a symmetry, then generically it is gapped. But now I'm focusing on the case where you put in a symmetry and you do have a gapless spectrum.
Right. Are you saying that you've proven independently of whatever argument solution like that if you have a strong symmetry that it's gapless, or what's the statement?
So this paper was not on that proof. Part of the work that led up to this has spiraled in another direction to try to explain why there is not an explicit proof, but there's as much evidence as you could possibly want without it, that you do have this case where it is gapless when you put in any symmetry.
For the gaplessness, do we also need to have like half integer local degrees of freedom?
Nope, anything.
Sorry, can I ask?
Sure. I don't know who that is, but please go ahead.
Yeah, sorry for asking an online question. But one thing you already mentioned is because of the commutant algebra, there is already a degeneracy of the ground state. So you're saying that on top of that, there is a gaplessness, or is the gaplessness also included in the fact that there is a high degeneracy?
Sorry, I didn't hear the last part. The commutant.
So you said that there is a... ground state degeneracy coming from the commutant algebra, right?
Right.
The dimension of the commutant algebra is the dimension of the ground space. So you're saying that, this ground space is also not gapped out in the presence of a symmetry? Is that what the statement is?
That it's not gapped out?
Yeah, in the presence of a symmetry.
Yes, in the presence of a symmetry, it's not gapped out.
I see. Okay.
Can I ask,
thanks.
Well, what's the connection between the picture in the middle and everything else?
Oh, this is a very generic poor animation of symmetry breaking that, if you have some, you have some potential like this, then you have some modes that are going around the circle. If you have some U1 symmetry that are, low energy.
So what's the connection between spontaneous symmetry breaking and this?
I hope that'll become clear in a bit, but I haven't quite gotten there. I'll try to speed through, and hopefully some of these things will be apparent as we go through.
So just to check though, when you talk about symmetries, are you always meaning continuous symmetries? Because discrete symmetries, I assume, can be directed by.
Yes, I'm always talking about continuous symmetries in this case. Discrete symmetries are very interesting in their own right. I'll give a little bit of that at the end if I have time. But yes, in this case, always continuous. So I'm going to pick up the pace a bit. Please do interrupt me if things are confusing. Effectively, the key message is we want to look at this duality between a dispersion. Namely, as I said before, if we have a quadratic dispersion, then it will lead to diffusion in the late time autocorrelation function. Now to do this, as I said, we're going to look at charge fluctuations. And we're going to look at, as I said, if it's charge fluctuation, if it's U1 symmetry commutes with it, then each of these root Hamiltonian should commute with the total charge. We can decompose the ground state into different charge sectors. So not only do we have the identity or the total charge, we have different charge sectors for each one. On top of those charge sectors, we can add these charge fluctuations. So now we're going to be looking at charge fluctuations in the diagonal component of this U1 symmetry, which is the sum of charge on the left and right components. So now we'll get some variational ansatz, we'll get some charge fluctuation, some normalization. And what we'll look at in particular is just some expected energy for these charge fluctuations. Now, if you recall the form of this effective Hamiltonian, the sum of each of these squares, because each of these components will kill one of these charge sectors.
What is PM?
It's a charge sector of the identity matrix. So the identity matrix is going to have support on all different charge sectors. And so if we want to look at excitations, some charge fluctuations, we'll project to a particular charge sector, and then we'll do excitations over that. It's a good question. So yes, if we want to look at expectation values of these charge fluctuations, we know that each of these root Hamiltonians will kill each of these PM, these charge sectors. And so we can convert this expectation of the total effective Hamiltonian into an expectation of commutators with the charge fluctuation operator, the Fourier modes of the charge. And so all we have to look at is the commutator to figure out the dynamics. Now, that's very important because since we already know that these Hamiltonians commute with the total charge, then if we expand out this Fourier component, we know that the first component, you know, when k is 0, will be annihilated. It means it will commute with it by definition, which means in this exponential expansion, the first term that should survive will be linear in k in this commutator. But because this appears squared in the total expectation, we immediately infer that the expected energy should be quadratic. So that's really it. We just had to look at some commutator with some Fourier mode of the charge with this root Hamiltonian, and we can immediately infer what the low energy dispersion should look like. However, what I've done here was look at some variational estimate. Now, you might actually doubt, or you should reasonably be a bit suspicious about whether or not this gives us access to the true dispersion. I'm going to blitz through this because there are some other results I think are more interesting. Effectively, you have to check that each of these variational states is orthogonal to one another. If they are orthogonal, then the dispersion you get from this expected energy should reproduce the real dispersion of the total Hamiltonian, you know, up to some constant factor.
So if they're not orthogonal, does the k squared dispersion provide an upper bound of the true dispersion?
No. If they're not orthogonal, then you can have a gapped state. An easy way to see that is if you have a gapped spectrum and you create a variational state which is just mostly weighted on the ground state and then a tiny weight on some gapped excited state, then the expected energy of that can be vanishing in system size even though you have a gapped spectrum. So effectively, you need to be careful about the orthogonality and that the ground state is part of this variational ensemble. Again, I'm going to blitz through this a bit quickly. Just this this technique for justifying variational states, famously used by Feynman, to get the dispersion for superfluid helium. It was important because you have to check both the states themselves and their normalization factor, which he used to show that superfluid helium has linear low energy excitations. I'm going to go through some of the more interesting phenomena. I'll move a little quickly, so please stop me if there you have any questions. Namely, if we have multiple symmetry, here I'm showing that for dipole symmetry, you'll have a sharper dispersion. In this case, it'll be k to the fourth and slower dynamics leading to subdiffusion. So this is actually relatively simple to do. As I said before, all you need to do to figure out the case for charge conservation was to look at the commutator with this root Hamiltonian. Except before, this root Hamiltonian commuted with just the charge operator. Now it will commute with the operator, you know, this multipole component. And so we do the exact same thing. We expand out the Fourier mode, except now it will commute all the way up to the nth moment. And thus, the last surviving term will be k to the m plus 1. And so the expected energy should be k to the 2, m plus 1. And so if you have a dipole conserving system, you would expect the dynamics to be slower, as can be shown in this figure, effectively because there are fewer moves available to a dipole. A dipole has to satisfy both the charge conservation and the dipole conservation. There are fewer moves available, so it moves more slowly. Except there's a little hitch here where I've assumed that this normalization is constant. Now, that's important because in multiple conserving systems, you have something called Hilbert space fragmentation, which means that within a particular symmetry sector, you have different dynamically disconnected sectors. These are called Krylov subspaces, or Kirlov. I've never learned how to pronounce it correctly. And these are just all the states that are, you know, dynamically connected here by just evolving as far as you possibly can be seen here. So if this is a symmetry sector, you have multiple different sectors that are dynamically connected. In this case, you can understand why they're not connected, because momentum and the multipole moment do not commute. Multipole moment has a component of position within it. And so since it doesn't commute, we can't simultaneously diagonalize both of them and have a nice symmetry sector connecting everything. This is an aspect of ergodicity breaking. You may be familiar with it from quantum many-body scars. However, here, we're looking at Hilbert space fragmentation. Like I said, we have these different vectors. It's important because there are two types. Weak Hilbert space fragmentation means that the largest of these Kirlov sectors within the total symmetry sector is going to be commensurate to the total symmetry sector size, in which case, you know, everything that we did before, we take an expectation value of the total, the variational state, it should be approximately constant, it should be approximately fill this symmetry sector. However, there's another type, strong Hilbert space fragmentation, where in the largest symmetry sector vanishes in system size. And so in that case, you have to be a bit more careful in deriving these dispersing states. And so it might seem like we have a problem. It might seem like we can't actually describe what happens in all multiple conserving systems. However, now I'm going to tell you very, very quickly about restricting to these different Kirlov subspaces. What we'll see is you can recover some faster dynamics. Effectively, you do exactly what I said. You restrict to these Kirlov subspaces. And now we're going to look at these ones, which might appear in strongly fragmented systems, or particular spaces in weakly fragmented ones, where at low momentum, this normalization vanishes. The way to do this is effectively recognize if you take the entire subspace, that subspace should be invariant under the dynamics, so it should be a ground state. Then if we want to look for things that vanish at low momentum, there's a very, very easy, or there's an intuitive guess, which are simply things that have bounded pth order multipole fluctuations. That's effectively because if you look at this structure factor. It will, if they're pth order fluctuations, they're going to be pth order derivatives of some of these fluctuations, and they'll give you some factor k to the 2p. We can talk about it more later if you have questions. But effectively what this means in the case of dipole symmetry is if we restrict to a sector where the dipole fluctuations themselves are bounded, then we can actually recover diffusion. We can recover diffusion in a dipole conserving system, which we demonstrated numerically here. And there's one very easy to see random unitary chain there where this can explicitly be seen. And so this can be seen by just changing this structure factor or this normalization factor, wherein now you can recover dynamics that is changed by this order of bounded fluctuations. And this is actually a new result that we showed in our paper. I'm going to blitz onto some long-range interactions, as I said, governed by some parameter alpha. This will cause different phases, here shown by the dotted lines. Specifically, I'm going to focus on interactions which are hoppings with some weight by inverse distance to power alpha. And again, all we need to do is look at this commutator. When we look at this commutator, now instead of just looking at, you know, the commutator with the site locally, we now have something which depends on the distance. And so calculating what the expected energy is actually going to be an integral over the entire system with the product of these two commutators. It'll give this integral below. And I'll spare you all the details of doing this integral, but needless to say, it's alpha dependent. For alpha less than half the system size, it's extensive with this exponent. And when it's greater than at low energies, it takes this form, which has either k squared or k to the 2 alpha minus d. Now that means that there will actually be three different cases or three different phases of low energy dynamics. This is shown for multipole hopping operators. Now, if alpha is extremely large, then you would expect our dynamics would effectively look local. And so you would expect that you would have the same multipole exponent, 2 to the n plus 1. That's exactly what you would expect. When alpha is extremely small, what that means is effectively you have non-local multipole dynamics. So there's hopping between different multipoles, you know, over the entire system. And so the dynamics, like the actual spreading of the dynamics, is governed actually from the different hoppings that constitute these multipole operators themselves. So if this is a dipole operator, you have, say, like four creation and annihilation operators. And instead, what you will, if these are non-local, the hoppings will actually happen internal to this. You'll have charge hoppings internal to this when the dipoles themselves are non-local. And then at some intermediary phase, you have some, you know, critical alpha-dependent behavior. So as I said, you'll have three different regimes governed by alpha, where you have different ranges of dispersion and thus dynamics. And so this is what we covered in the paper. It's just the beginning. Again, this is just a very intuitive framework to understand a plethora of phenomena. We can cover multipole symmetries just by looking at the commutator with the different interactions. It gives us our dispersion immediately. We can look at Kirilov constrained dynamics just by looking at particular sectors. And that, you know, that can further inform different dynamics in different sectors. We can look at long-range interactions with some parameter alpha and immediately infer what the dynamics, what the dispersion and the dynamics should look like. But importantly, one of the things that I haven't mentioned, and one of the reasons this is so nice in comparison to Haar averaging or typical procedures, is that I haven't had to add anything onto this framework, and it applies unbelievably widely. The first case, I've been doing things in a U1 symmetry just for ease of expression, but this applies equally well to non-abelian symmetries. At no point did I have to restrict to a particular representation and maintain in some symmetry sector as we did before. A really clear example is before we talked about excitations, charge fluctuations in the Z basis. Well, if I have an SU2 symmetry, you know, there's some commutation between X, Y, and Z charges, Well, if I want to convert my dynamics and look at something happening in the x basis, well, I can just apply this commutator with y, which would be the expression, you know, this difference of y charges here. And importantly, this, because it is a charge of the system, it will commute with our Hamiltonian, and you'll get exactly the same dynamics. And so it's a bit boring, but what this says is everything that I've said applies equally well for non-abelian symmetries and abelian symmetries immediately. It falls right out of the formalism. And finally, in many cases, some of these systems are made easier by adding Ancilla states or qubits, or taking some large N expansion for the local Hilbert space dimension. Completely unnecessary here. You can do things in any dimension. It can be for, you know, half spin operators or full spin. Now, finally, what was raised a few times before, we can look at.
We've already gone over now, so
sure.
Take too much longer.
Sure, I'll blitz through. So we can look at the system more generally. You can just apply the Choi isomorphism to take arbitrary Lindblad evolution, which is here. That will give you an effective Hamiltonian that looks like this. Importantly, it's non-Hermitian. You see, if your Hamiltonian is Hermitian, this part is non-Hermitian. If you apply charge conservation, you can get U1 charge conservation. You can get a dispersion that looks like this. What effectively that means is you're going to have diffusion, but there's going to be a moving operator front for that diffusing operator. This is different from the ballistic front before. It's just for these moving operators. This is the ugly form of each of these operators. Future directions, you can expand this up to multiple copies of a system relatively easily. Look at K designs. Look at time to approximate to a K design. And then you can incorporate measurement relatively easily. This is important because there are lots of results on obtaining different dynamical phases when you put in discrete symmetries and you apply measurement. And there are interesting different phase transitions. Here, this one is if you measure at a particular rate, very, very quickly, you can purify to a pure state. Slow measurement, it's still in mixed state. Some intermediate rare area, you can measure quickly enough to realize what the charge sector you are in is without being in a pure state. And future directions, I'd like to look at more general classification and entanglement dynamics, which can be accomplished with particular operators and expectations here. So I'd like to thank some of my collaborators, Professor Sunwon Choi, who set me up on this work a few years ago and who's been really helpful, Johannes Feldmeier, who's the only reason I understand anything about Hilbert space fragmentation, and Zhongyun, who recently got a position at UIC, who's been a fantastic mentor and guide along the way. So thank you.
Thanks very much. Some questions.
I have some questions. can you go to the slide for strong and weak symmetries?
Sure.
I think there you say strong and weak symmetries, you refer to the symmetries of the double states, right?
Yes, I did that just to make it clear in this formalism.
In terms of the original physical, look at this picture, yeah. So this picture means I have a system that undergoes some Hamiltonian evolution, and the Hamiltonian may be time-dependent, space-dependent, with some random noise, right? So in this case, the dynamics would be described by the framework slide, the slide where you wrote down framework. You have some edge and some dB. Later you have a slide with framework. If I consider such physical system, the dynamics would be described by this kind of Hamiltonian with some randomness in the dB. Then what strong symmetry mean in terms of this physical Hamiltonian? It seems it just means that H alpha commutes with the charge, right?
Well, so what's important to note is if I'm looking at the dynamics of this operator, it's being hit by a unitary on both sides, right? You have Heisenberg evolution like this. And so when we translate that Heisenberg evolution into a Schrodinger evolution, we have Because we've written things in this particular framework, because we are only looking at squared terms, since only the variance of the Brownian weight survives, then each of the terms in the resultant Lindblad evolution is squared, and it applies on both the left and the right of the operator. So if something commutes with this H alpha, then there's going to be commutation with, you know, operating on the right and operating on the left. So if you're looking at it on the level of the interactions with the Hamiltonian, then you're immediately looking at things on the level of a strong symmetry. If you look at it on the level of like what the resultant density matrix will look like, the resultant density matrix averaged over, or the whole full resultant density matrix, if that will commute with the Hamiltonian, that means that you can have some interactions that do not respect this symmetry, but the average over all of them should.
I understand what strong and weak symmetries mean. In the physical system you are studying, in the previous picture where you have the animation, is described by this Hamiltonian, then strong symmetry just means that H alpha commutes with the charge.
Yeah.
My question is, when can you have the weak symmetry?
When can you have the weak symmetry? You can have the weak symmetry.
That means the Hamiltonian doesn't have the symmetry, right?
The effective Hamiltonian?
No, not the effective Hamiltonian, the physical Hamiltonian.
Yes, exactly. The effective the physical Hamiltonian does not have the symmetry, but you can have the independent terms of your physical Hamiltonian does not have the physical symmetry. And this is actually easiest understood, is if you take, say, the Lindbladian, shouldn't have put this at the end, but if you take the Lindbladian of the system, then the sum of all the different jump operators, or the jump operators on both sides, will have this, will commute with this symmetry. So the jump operators, as you said, comes from these interacting terms. But you can have, you know, depending on the interactions with your environment, you can have jump operators which individually do not commute with the symmetry, but if you take the sum over all of them, then they will.
Mm-hmm. So if I have a physical system that does have the symmetry, then in this double state, then
it's strong.
I will have the strong symmetry automatically.
Yes.
Okay. The second question is, so what's the connection between the spontaneous symmetry breaking and everything else on that slide?
Well, effectively, when you translate this you know, dynamics into an effective Hamiltonian, then you have symmetry breaking, and the low energy modes are your symmetry breaking modes. They're your Goldstone bosons.
But why do I have to have symmetry breaking?
Why do you have to have symmetry breaking?
If we go to that picture of Mexican hat,
yeah.
What do the degenerate ground states mean in this case?
The degenerate ground states are your different symmetry sectors with the diagonal symmetry space. So the U1 cross U1 has, you know, basically the sum and difference of the U1 symmetry on the left and right space. Both of those exist. And so you're looking at excitations over one of them.
So you mean each point in the bottom of the Mexican hat is representing some charge?
Yes, you are rotating between different charge.
But charges are represented by integers, right? Why do I have a continuous?
It's large because the allowable charge is going to be extensive in the system size.
There are
two different notions of charge that are important to keep track of. So there's the diagonal and the off-diagonal. So one of them is this difference in charges at each site. The other is going to be the sum of these charges at each site. Both of those in a strong symmetry should be independently conserved because, well, you know, each one at each site is going to be independently conserved. If we look at the excitations, of course. Right, so the excitations are looking at the excitations of the sum of these two ones that you're rotating. you can rotate each of these rotation by this should not change will not change anything within the symmetry sector by this diagonal charge. So if you take a ground state, you can apply some rotation this diagonal symmetry, and it will just take you to another ground state. Now you apply some small fluctuations locally to that, and you get your Goldstone modes here. I'm sorry if I explained that poorly.
So which Hamiltonian has Hamiltonian symmetry breaking?
The effective Hamiltonian, HL here.
You mean necessarily has Hamiltonian symmetry breaking?
Yes.
There's no way to tune the parameter, so the symmetry is not broken.
I'm sure if you found some very fine tuning, you could find some way to avoid it, but generically, yes.
And at which step did you use the condition that the initial density matrix is the maximum mixed state?
So that was kind of implied in the fact that the jump operators that I used were Hermitian. So each of the interaction terms, the H alpha there, saying that those were Hermitian, the Lindblad evolution that leads to, effectively that means that your ground state is going to be the identity matrix, which is the maximally mixed state. And that is kind of almost by definition saying that it's an infinite temperature ensemble. Now, if I change things so that those jump operators are non-Hermitian, or I look at more general Lindblad evolution, then the infinite time limit or the ground state can take a more general form. And so those infinite time states or those steady states can then potentially be finite temperature states.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for the Hermitian case, K linear case.
Mm-hmm.
So the charge is still diffuse. What was the ballistic part?
So the charge is still diffuse, but now there's a front. So the front is going to move ballistically, but the front itself is going to diffuse slowly. So effectively, that imaginary component, if you integrate over all different momentum modes, the momenta is going to have some, if you're doing some integral over some e to the negative h t, and then you have to integrate over some overlap with some momentum modes, you're going to have some momentum component where, if you're starting at some localized operator, starts at x, be some e to the I k x minus whatever point you're considering, y. Now, importantly, if this has some component which goes, the energy goes as I v t, then the low energy modes are going to have some component that you would put in here, which would be some, plus or minus v t. And effectively, that just means that the dynamics that you're going to have, instead of having some slow diffusion at some point zero, it's going to be that you're going to have a front that moves with some velocity v. I don't know if that makes it clear, if that was more confusing.
The width still grows as square root of t.
Exactly. Sorry if it was a bit confusing. I'm very, very happy to talk with people a bit more about things. I'm particularly interested in understanding this non-Hermitian aspect of it, because I think that's where most of the interesting dynamics actually occur. Very happy to talk more later if people would like.
Thank you. Thanks for that.